It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It wasn't the longest inaugural address ever. Historians will decide whether it was one of the truly great ones. But given the economic state of affairs, it might well have been one of the most important. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is the 20th of January today, Inauguration Day. Obviously, great to have you with us. It didn't take long for the president to get to the point in his speech this morning, a minute and a half by my watch.
Our economy is badly weakened, a consequence of greed and irresponsibility on the part of some, but also our collective failure to make hard choices and prepare the nation for a new age.
Too many homes have been lost, he said. Healthcare is too expensive and too many people are out of work. And those are just the things we can count.
Less measurable, but no less profound, is a sapping of confidence across our land. A nagging fear that America's decline is inevitable, that the next generation must lower its sights.
Something, he said, that this country has worked too hard to let happen.
Our workers are no less productive than when this crisis began. Our minds are no less inventive. Our goods and services no less needed than they were last week or last month or last year. Our capacity remains undiminished. But our time of standing pat, of protecting narrow interests and putting off unpleasant decisions, that time has surely passed.
Which is right about where the inaugural address became a little bit of a stump speech, to be honest. Promises of more jobs and better infrastructure, smarter power grids and digital access, a new energy policy and better education. If that sounds like a lot, well, it is.
What the cynics fail to understand is that the ground has shifted beneath them, that the stale political arguments that have consumed us for so long no longer apply. The question we ask today is not whether our government is too big or too small, but whether it works, whether it helps families find jobs at a decent wage, care they can afford, a retirement that is dignified. Where the answer is yes, we intend to move forward. Where the answer is no, programs will end.
And don't even get them started on the free market.
Its power to generate wealth and expand freedom is unmatched. But this crisis has reminded us that without a watchful eye, the market can spin out of control. The nation cannot prosper long when it favors only the prosperous.
Economists will tell you that jobs are the way back to that prosperity. And even though this was a work day, today's historic inauguration was must-see TV for millions of people. Lots of Americans took matters into their own hands and took the day off, either with vacation or with a sick day or at least a long lunch break. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson was working today. He spent the morning in Harlem with a crowd watching the festivities. That was the sound from the crowd on 125th Street when the Jumbotron showed President Obama emerging for the first time. And many of those cheers were coming from people who were playing hooky. William James didn't ask for the day off. He just took it.
I called. I'm sick. I said I'm sick and I wanted to come and watch this. So I took off the day. Hopefully they're not listening.
Renee Hunter was honest about her absence. She's in the real estate business.
Had some big-time clients this morning, but I told them I have to watch the inauguration, and they were just fine with it.
Some didn't have to ask permission, like Kevin Wilson. He's the boss of a tattoo parlor.
And you just gave everybody the day off work?
No, actually everybody's supposed to be there, but since I'm the boss, I can kind of let it slide. So what am I going to do, fire myself?
Getting fired wasn't a concern for Barbara Johnson. She just got lucky.
Well, it just so happened that Monday and Tuesdays, I just got those days Thursday, and I'm like, that's cool, because this is a historical event. Nobody wants to miss this.
Across the street from the Jumbotron, Jerry Kunjar, the boss of a men's clothing store, was stocking the shelves. He says no employees asked for the day off.
I guess when it comes to 12 o'clock, I guess I'm going to have to try to control them, you know?
Let me ask you this. If they had asked for the day off, would you have given it to them?
I would have worked it out. A few people that asked for it would have got the day off, yeah.
Clear across town in the West Village, Paul Worthington played nice boss. Some of his employees went to Washington to watch in person.
Only a couple that I'm aware of, but I'm sure there may be others that I'm not aware of.
For those that did stay and work, there was pizza, soda, and a big screen TV.
Everybody got out of their seats and walked over and stood in front and gave a big round of applause when he was sworn in.
But the TV was off long before the parade started, and it was back to work. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace. You know who else was working today, but who maybe we wish wasn't? Traders on Wall Street. They kicked off the Obama administration with a serious sell-off. We will have the details when we do the numbers. All the political pomp and circumstance in Washington today didn't amount to a hill of beans on Wall Street. In case you took the day off from the financial crisis to celebrate the inauguration, here's the update. Bank of America lost almost a third of its value today. Citigroup can now be had for $3.50 a share. The rumors of nationalization or some kind of Uber bailout known as a bad bank are getting stronger. In fact, the British government has already taken huge ownership stakes in some of its biggest banks. Economist Simon Johnson teaches at MIT. He also used to work at the International Monetary Fund. Professor Johnson, good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
What's your sense of the banking industry in the United States, specifically the big ones, Citigroup and Bank of America, that have been in so much trouble?
Well, I'm worried, but that's not the issue. The markets are very worried, and they're very worried on a sort of an immediate pressing basis, and that's a huge issue for the incoming administration.
One of the things that's been talked about as a solution is this thing called a bad bank that would absorb some of these bad assets that the banks have on their books. What exactly would that entail?
Well, the basic notion of a bad bank is that you split the assets of these banks. You let the banks determine, maybe with some government help, which parts they should hive off into the bad bank, and you split what the shareholders get, so they get part of the good bank and part of the bad bank. And then you hope that the good bank can go on and make loans and go about its business. There's a wall between that and the bad bank. And anything that goes further wrong in the bad bank or any massive uncertainty about the holdings of the bad bank shouldn't affect the good bank.
All right, but wait a minute. Didn't we go down this road a little bit back in October when Secretary Paulson came up with this plan known as the TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Plan, that we would just take all those bad things and the good banks would be fine?
Well, there was an idea. Actually, it was back in September. The original idea was that the government would buy these so-called troubled assets. That never actually happened. The government switched course in mid-October and went into the business of recapitalizing the banks, and it left the troubled assets on the balance sheets of the banks. So in a sense, we are coming full circle, but I think the sense is now that you come full circle in a much bigger, more decisive way, and you combine toxic waste cleanup, that's getting rid of the bad debt, with big recapitalization of the banks, whether they like it or not.
And this recapitalization, if you do it on a large enough scale, that in essence becomes nationalization, doesn't it?
Well, no, I don't think it does. Nationalization is something that's going to happen in some European countries. The government will take 100% ownership stake and it'll run the banks. In the US, I really don't believe that is going to happen or that that would be a good idea. I think what will happen is the government will inject capital. The government will get some claims on the banks. Let's call it warrants, so the options to buy shares in the banks. And then the government will manage those stakes through a resolution trust corporation kind of structure. That's what we used after the savings and loans debacle in the 1980s. And this RTC will get rid of the stakes. It'll sell them, for example, to private equity, which we know is waiting with deep pockets on the sidelines. So sell it to private equity. Private equity can buy these banks and I would think break them up into smaller, more sensible, manageable units. Oh, and I think they would also fire a lot of the managers, the top managers along the way.
What a shock. Would this then, if we do this, if we get all these bad assets into one bad bank, would that simplify things?
What it should do and simplify the business of banking. So it should allow banks to move on and to make their own decisions about who to lend to without worrying about the sort of overhang of this bad debt and the various kinds of problems that it brings with it. So it separates the problems between banking on the one side and fiscal on the other side. And at this stage, I think we need it.
What's your sense of how much time we have to figure this out? I mean, Bank of America and Citigroup aren't getting any richer by the day, are they?
Yes. Well, if it was just about the United States, I would say we would have a bit of time. Unfortunately, the global situation is not cooperating at all. The situation in Europe is dramatically worsened over the past week. And I think this may force the new administration's hand rather sooner than they may wish.
Simon Johnson at MIT, the Peterson Institute, and the blog Baseline Scenario. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
Over in the UK, bank shares took a drubbing for the second day running today. Royal Bank of Scotland fell 11% in London. That's after having plunged almost 70% yesterday. Not quite the reaction the British government might have been hoping for. Prime Minister Gordon Brown has just unveiled a second major package of measures to help the banking sector over there. From the European desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
Britain's first banking bailout last October saved the banking system from crashing and was hailed a masterstroke. But yesterday's effort to get the banks lending again has not gone down so well. One of the main elements is an insurance scheme. The government will insure the banks against losses from their toxic assets. Opposition politician Vince Cable is one of the many critics.
You can't have meaningful insurance until you know the value of the underlying assets, these bad debts. It is seriously scary that the government is embarking on this with so little detail.
He says this looks like a blank cheque for the banks, but the government says the insurance will come with strings attached. Banks that sign up to the scheme will have to commit themselves to a specific increase in lending. That's proved unpopular with investors. It seems to have caused the collapse in bank shares. Not surprising, says fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart. After all, who wants to invest in a bank dictated to by the government?
The banks are now going to be operating for the benefit of the community. They're going to be seen as utilities, just like any other water and electricity company. They will not be as profitable as before.
Other analysts say the two-day slide in bank shares suggests that a third British bailout plan may not be far away. And that will be the most drastic, bringing outright nationalisation to three or four major banks. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
In this country this year, close to $700 billion in corporate debt is going to come due. Firms are scrambling to refinance a lot of it, but with so many banks still choking on billions in bad mortgages and institutional investors afraid of lending money to any but the strongest corporations, a lot of companies might have a hard time coming up with the cash they need. Marketplace's Steve Henn reminds us that this crisis we're in used to be called a credit crunch.
Circuit City just went bankrupt after failing to refinance its debt. Close to 30,000 employees will lose their jobs, and hundreds of stores across the country are closing. And this may be just the beginning.
There's going to be a lot of bankruptcies this year.
Diane Vaza is Standard & Poor's expert on corporate debt markets.
Right now, we are swirling in the epicenter of, you know, not only deep recessionary conditions, but in unprecedented, tight lending conditions with financial institutions who are in rough shape themselves.
Precious few companies can borrow these days for less than 10% a year. For companies with less than stellar credit, interest rates have skyrocketed.
Well, now it's close to 15%. 15% over treasuries.
So what kind of firm can afford to pay that kind of interest?
Virtually none.
Vaza says any firm in America that doesn't have an investment-grade credit rating could be vulnerable. And that includes Eddie Bauer, Krispy Kreme, Rite Aid, and Six Flags.
So you're looking at lots of companies, you know, retailers, you're looking at restaurants, consumer product discretionary types of companies, media and entertainment companies.
Ed Liebert's chairman of the National Association of Corporate Treasurers.
Treasurers are going to have to use all their creative abilities.
But Vaza says no amount of creativity is going to solve this problem. Instead, she says, brace yourself for a big wave of corporate bankruptcies. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The speech President Obama gave today was in part sobering, coming as it did in the middle of the worst economic crisis in decades. At the same time, though, there was a can-do attitude about it, too. Mixed feelings might also be the order of the day for a lot of African Americans. Today is a historic milestone. But commentator Amelia Tiagi says the economy is creating milestones of a different sort.
Perhaps 2009 will be remembered as the most ironic year in African American history. On the one hand, we have our first African American president, a milestone of unprecedented importance. And yet, 2009 may also go down in history as the year that more African Americans fell out of the middle class than any other time in our nation's past. Best estimates are that African American homeowners are 2.5 times more likely to be in foreclosure than their white counterparts. At that rate, more than 1 million African American homeowners will lose their home in the next 4 years. That's 1 in every 5. Why is the trouble so much worse for African Americans? Because they were specifically targeted by banks peddling dangerous subprime mortgages. When people applied for home mortgages, blacks were far more likely than whites to receive the high-cost loans. And this isn't just about credit scores and other assets. In fact, residents in high-income African American neighborhoods are now more likely to have a subprime mortgage than residents in low-income white neighborhoods. Brandon Etheridge is a law student from a largely African-American middle-class neighborhood outside Baltimore. He described a family on his block, two professionals who came home from work one day and the lights had been turned out. A bank official was outside. They had to move their stuff out in the middle of the night. By the time a family loses their home, they have drained their bank account, ruined their credit score, and cashed out their retirement savings, all in a desperate attempt to save the home. For many, this is the end of the American dream. Many in Brandon's neighborhood are first-generation homeowners, victors in a hard-fought battle to climb up the economic ladder. In the swirl of the subprime crisis, African-American homeownership rates are poised to lose an entire generation of progress in a few short years. Brandon remarked, "No one thinks about this as a civil rights issue, but maybe we should."
Amelia Warren Tiagi is the co-founder of the Business Talent Group. We'd love to hear what you think. Send us your comments. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, inaugural balls put away the fancy fare.
You know, the foods that we're doing are much more comfort foods and, you know, sliced hams and turkeys and things like that, which don't really read expensive.
But first, let's do the numbers. Today, more fallout in financial markets aggravated already nervous investors. The Dow Industrials dropped 332 points, 4%, closed at 7,949. The biggest inauguration day drop since 1900, by the by. The NASDAQ fell 88 points, more than 5.75%, settled at 1440. The S&P 500 lost 44 points, 5.25%, wrapped up at 805. Investors headed for the exits on banking stocks after the Royal Bank of Scotland reported the biggest loss in British corporate history yesterday. Awash in unrealized bond losses, institutional money manager State Street Corporation plunged 59% today. J.P. Morgan Chase chased away more than 20%. Bank of America dropped almost 29%. Wells Fargo sank about 24% today. Worries about earnings projections pushed tech stocks down. Apple slid 5%. Microsoft slipped 6.25%. IBM lost 3.5% today. Bond prices rose. That sent the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.38%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, the email marketing service dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. ConstantContact.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a simple guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. On his first full day in office, President Obama attends a national prayer service, and he's generally expected to be pretty busy. Confirmation hearings continue for Timothy Geithner to be Treasury Secretary. He helped broker the sale of Bear Stearns to J.P. Morgan when the investment bank collapsed last year. And the House Energy and Commerce Committee discusses pushing out the date for digital television transition. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
You had a lot to say this week about what I've been saying in interviews. One of those interviews was with Adam Michelson. He used to be a marketing executive at Countrywide, the failed mortgage provider. Some of you wrote to say I was too nice to him. Many agreed that Michelson and his colleagues at Countrywide are to blame, at least in part, for the dire state of the economy. But software developer Anand Kothari has a different view. He says we shouldn't criticize corporations that encourage us to spend and take risks.
The very basis of capitalism encourages to take debt to consume and invest such that future earnings will create ability to repay debt while enjoying high level of lifestyle. If someone must be blamed, it should be on the Fed economists and regulatory agencies that allowed and fueled growth with flawed risk models.
I had a chat with management consultant Charles Handy the other day, part of our series Taking Stock, where we take a wider perspective. He and I talked about the economy and the banking system, and then about how it might be better if we all had to slow down a little bit, spend less, enjoy life more. Chris Peckman of Roanoke, Virginia, couldn't have agreed more.
I think many of us are yearning for the sanity that Charles Handy is talking about. So to fix the economy, we do not need tax cuts so we can spend more on unnecessary stuff. We need to create jobs for the common good, jobs to build the green infrastructure that can help us out of the mess we have put ourselves into.
Of course, that economic mess isn't the only thing we've been covering. I interviewed Steve Knopper of Rolling Stone magazine last week about music sales, the demise of compact discs, and the rise, or resurgence, I should say, of another kind of record, the vinyl kind. Here's student and musician Brian Whitaker.
Many reasons were listed for this phenomenon, namely having the media in your hands to hold and adore. However, there was one very important reason behind this resurgence that was missed. It simply sounds better.
There was one other thing I was a little short-sighted about last week. Alex Phillips from Amherst, Massachusetts, picked up on it when I made a reference to computer users. Mac guys or Windows guys, I said.
By failing to acknowledge that there are plenty of gals out there with serious opinions about computers, you're perpetuating a nasty stereotype. But there is one stereotype that may just hold true. As a musician and poet, I always keep my MacBook with me. But my girlfriend, a scientist, never strays from her trusted PC.
Whether you're writing to us on your PC or on your Mac or maybe even your BlackBerry, and whether you're a guy or a girl, we always appreciate your comments. Drop us a note at our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Even though he's been going all day already, President Obama's got an even longer night ahead of him. He's going to drop in on 10 inaugural balls tonight, as in fancy formal parties, right? And, in fact, inaugural balls used to be the real deal. Great food, champagne, elegant attire. But times have changed. Now you're lucky to get cardboard chicken to eat. Balls have been known to end with near riots at the Kochak. And this year, some have scaled back even more because of the economy. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports.
Most of us think of inaugural balls as grand affairs. Well, think again. Balls have been going downhill for years.
The ball was a little disappointing. Definitely was like being almost back at a school dance.
That wasn't exactly what Kim Sundy had in mind when she went to a youth ball for President Clinton's first inauguration.
When you watch balls and events on television, you always have this grandiose idea of, I'll feel like Cinderella when I'm there, and there will be, you know, tablecloths and all these things.
Things like good food, candles, and fine china. Instead, inaugural balls these days are like cattle calls. The food is crummy, sometimes just snacks. There's a cash bar, wine and beer served in plastic cups. It wasn't always this way. Bring in that music again. Dolly Madison hosted the first inaugural ball in 1809. She offered champagne and Charlotte Chantilly. At James Buchanan's inaugural ball in 1857, they served 400 gallons of oysters and 1,200 quarts of ice cream. More than 100 years later, Jimmy Carter became one of the first presidents to tone things down. The Georgia peanut farmer served peanuts at his inaugural balls. He tried to limit ticket prices to $25. Alan Lichtman is a presidential historian at American University.
This was very consciously part of a strategy on the part of Jimmy Carter to suggest, well, this isn't going to be a presidency of the rich and the privileged. This is going to be a presidency of the ordinary folks.
President Obama has tried to craft a similar populist image. Plus, he doesn't want to look too ostentatious in a recession. You would think that's bad news for Washington caterers. But the kitchen at Design Cuisine is buzzing. They're catering 30 inaugural events instead of a few more expensive ones. Co-owner Bill Homan says party hosts are avoiding things like caviar, which is tasty but in poor taste during a recession. But he says that hasn't affected his bottom line.
I think it's not necessarily spending less money. I think they're just changing what they're ordering. And, you know, the foods that we're doing are much more comfort foods and, you know, sliced hams and turkeys and things like that, which don't really read expensive.
That's sure to please the most honored guest at these balls, the new president. After all, he's the reason people put up with the crowds and bad food. They just want to catch a glimpse of Obama. If he's happy, they are too. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, one last item about the inauguration today. It is nothing if not a good marketing opportunity. That's a point that Audi seems to have picked right up on. I opened my Wall Street Journal this morning and out popped an 8-page Audi advertising supplement. Same thing I'm told was in USA Today, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post. Audi is sponsoring Slate.com today and the Atlantic Monthly's website, as well as inauguration recaps on the major broadcast networks. There'll be a Super Bowl ad in a couple of weeks, too, and ads on the Academy Awards, which does kind of make you wonder, with the global auto industry in a huge slump, where are they getting the money to pay for all that? That is Marketplace from American Public Media this 20th day of January, rather. Today, the Dow fell 332 points, 4%. The NASDAQ lost 88 points, 5.75%. The S&P 500 dropped 44 points. That's 5.25% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, a smaller role for America on the world stage?
Unfortunately, the domestic problems, the TARP and basically the stimulus, there's going to be so much money flowing out of the Treasury that there won't be a lot to spend on foreign policy.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.